ever had a traumatic event happen in your life? A day that perhaps you look back on, and if it pops into your head, it completely changes your mood. A traumatic event, maybe involving the death of someone close to you, or maybe you were in danger, but you escaped, and those frightening few minutes last for a lifetime. Well, imagine, if you would, a traumatic event where you went to go see the president, and he was shot dead before your eyes. Imagine a traumatic event where you were working on a Friday, eyeing the weekend, and the President of the United States was before you bleeding to death, and you're a doctor responsible for saving lives. Imagine a traumatic event where your job was to protect someone, only for that very person to be killed right in front of you. Imagine a traumatic event where, as a reporter, your question leads to the removal of a limousine's top, allowing a gunman a clear line of sight. I'm Eric Bushman. This is the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas. Let's start with that last hypothetical, except it's not a hypothetical at all. It was very real. It was real for Dallas Times Herald reporter Jim Lehrer. He was at Dallas Love Field. His assignment was to cover the arrival of President and Mrs. Kennedy, and then cover Kennedy's eventual return to Dallas Love Field, where he was to fly out to Austin. Lear approached a Secret Service officer as the clouds were beginning to disperse and asked if the bubble top was coming off the car. The Secret Service radioed downtown, observed the sky over the airport, and ordered the top off.
It was quite an event that kind of haunted me for a long time after that, because the Secret Service agent involved, you know, said to me later, oh my God, if I just hadn't taken the bubble top off. And not that the bubble top was bulletproof, it wasn't. It was just a quarter inch plexiglass. But the idea being that maybe Oswald might not have taken the shots if the bubble top had been up. If he had, even though it wasn't bulletproof, it might have deflected the shots. Who knows? Anyhow, all of that became part of my memory.
Lear believes, though, had he not asked, another reporter would have. And if no one asked, the top would have eventually come off per President Kennedy's rules.
I do. Absolutely, I do.
When the news of the shooting broke, many people learned as they were watching As the World Turns, a popular soap opera on CBS. Walter Cronkite interrupted the show.
And I thought about it, and I gave it a great deal of thought, Grandpa.
Here is a bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting. More details just arrived. These details, about the same as previously, President Kennedy shot today just as his motorcade left downtown Dallas. Mrs. Kennedy jumped up and grabbed Mr. Kennedy. She called, "Oh no," the motorcade sped on. United Press says that the wounds for President Kennedy perhaps could be fatal. Repeating, a bulletin from CBS News, President Kennedy has been shot by a would-be assassin in Dallas, Texas. Stay tuned to CBS News for further details.
But the person considered by many to be the most trusted man in America, while maintaining his composure through the unfolding coverage, nearly broke down when rumors of Kennedy's death were confirmed by the press secretary to reporters at Parkland Hospital.
October the 24th, that our ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson, was assaulted in Dallas, leaving a dinner meeting there. From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
Other journalists had delayed reactions. The end of the week went into a Friday night and Saturday morning on no rest and nonstop tension. Correspondent Sid Davis was a reporter for Westinghouse Broadcasting. He was outside the White House when an ambulance returned President Kennedy's body after the autopsy at Bethesda Naval Hospital. Davis was on the air for several minutes narrating what he was seeing to his audience. And when it came time to sign off, he decided to ad lib an ending, a few closing thoughts, and in doing so, everything caught up.
There's very little more we can say. In a manner of speaking, perhaps, John F. Kennedy has come home. I think one of the things that might be appropriate at this time, he liked to quote from Robert Frost many times on the campaign, and Mr. Frost was one of his favorites. Mr. Frost died earlier this year, but one of the president's favorite quotations, and I believe it went something like this: I have promises to keep and many miles to go before I sleep. And with that, this is Sid Davis reporting from the White House.
When Dallas Times-Herald reporter Jim Lehrer found out about the shooting, he was immediately reassigned from Dallas Love Field to Parkland Hospital, and then eventually to Dallas Police Headquarters. He told me that he basically spent the next several months of his life at that building. Even though he says he knows the limousine bubble top would have come off regardless of his question, he carried that thought with him for so long that eventually he was moved to write a novel about the experience, but using fictitious characters. The book is called Top Down.
This didn't happen in real life, but a fictional Secret Service agent, the guy who did order, you know, in the book to take the thing down, became, you know, completely overcome with guilt. And because there was another theory about the bubble top, which is if the bubble top had been up, it could have just shattered into a bunch of shards. It could have killed everybody in there, including both the Kennedys, both the Connellys, and the two Secret Service agents. But, anyhow, but nobody did much about it. And I was a reporter, and I didn't do much about it. I didn't really think about it. Only in recent years I began to think about it as a possibility, as a story. And I also had come to realize that Secret Service agents, there were about 50 of them involved in that whole Texas trip. And several of them had a lot of guilt feelings when it was over. And, you know, they would now call it PTSD, but they had trauma over the guilt because, you know, for a Secret Service agent, there's nothing worse than losing a president. So all of this finally came to me. It was not, it wasn't really a haunt, but it was just in my mind. And so that's when I decided to write a novel about it.
Lehrer adds that, to his knowledge, what he wrote in his novel is different from the real-life agent who he spoke with at the airport.
No matter what, the Secret Service agent should have not felt any guilt at all about this because it would have come off anyhow. But in my story, there was. The real Secret Service agent who took it off, as far as I know, because I didn't stay in contact with him afterward, as far as I know, did not have huge guilt about it or whatever. He did right afterward, you know, oh my God. He went on to have a full life and career at the Secret Service, so it didn't really destroy him.
The Secret Service. I can't even imagine.
We carried a lot of baggage from that day. There are not many jobs you can be 100% failure at, but when you're protecting a president who's assassinated, everybody felt they failed.
Gerald Blaine was not in the Dallas motorcade, but was a part of the Secret Service detail that covered the Texas trip.
There were 34 of us on the White House detail, usually five agents with the president at one time. And we worked 80 hours a month overtime, for which we did not get paid. The problem with that is pretty soon we all thought as one. We were like brothers emotionally and on the job. And when the president was assassinated, you know, you could read rationally that, you know, there wasn't anything you could do. But when one person suffers, everybody suffered.
Once President Kennedy died, they had no choice but to march forward and serve the next in line.
It was kind of a settling period and an unsettling period. And I think there were probably about four or five others that left when I did. But, our job was to protect the president. The problem was we had no trauma counseling. We just went ahead and we had to work twice as hard with the new president. And it's up to us to adjust to him.
When Blaine decided to tell the story, he partnered with a co-author, Lisa McCubbin. She did extensive research along with Blaine and Agent Clint Hill and discovered these agents had bottled everything in for decades.
There was no trauma counseling. They all went and continued to do the job they had to do. They were busier than ever before. Clint continued to protect Mrs. Kennedy for a year following the assassination. So they just buried all these feelings. And then I talked to a lot of the other agents and the same thing, just some really, you know, deep emotions came out.
Besides a book about the agents with the Secret Service at the time of the assassination, the entire project served as a way for the surviving agents at the time to reunite and speak about the trauma that enveloped them in the years afterward.
When the Discovery Channel decided to film this reunion of the agents based on our book, The Kennedy Detail, to see all the these men get together for the first time and talk about this amongst themselves, it was really emotional.
Dealing with the aftermath of the assassination, Dallas police have had to deal for years with people coming forward with this story or that story that may or may not have panned out. Detective Jim Lavelle says police have long had to deal with made-up stories from people simply wanting attention.
These people, many of them have tried to project themselves into this thing over the years. And unfortunately, some of our police officers have exaggerated their roles in the matter, too, along the way. I have always told mine straight up just like it is. In fact, some of the conspiracy people said, we don't even want to talk to you because you haven't changed your story. It's the same one now as it was back in 63. Mm-hmm. Well, I only done so much on it, and that's all I can tell them about it. It's what I know, what I did.
Detective Lavelle's story has been told countless times, including by someone who admires Lavelle like a family member, literally. His granddaughter, Kate Grindling, is a filmmaker and producer.
After I flew a crew down here in 2011 and did a bunch of interviews with his colleagues and friends, I took all of the material back home and started looking over the transcripts and footage, and there was just one story about the DPD that just kept standing out and speaking out to me, and it became too hard to ignore.
Grindling made a documentary about the Dallas police in the immediate aftermath of the assassination, not only to honor her grandfather, but to put the spotlight on the actions of the Dallas Police Department. And she wants to tell the whole story.
I'm not shy about pointing out what the DPD did wrong. And certainly by not having enough guards up and transferring Oswald when they did, they'll tell you that they compromised their investigation by losing their prime suspect.
Grindling wanted to remind people in her documentary, Capturing Oswald, for the Military Channel, about how quickly investigators tracked down their suspect.
The fact in 1963 that they were able to capture not only one, but a couple of different people within those first 88 minutes is pretty remarkable. And the fact that they got it right with Oswald just goes to show the, there's a little bit of luck. There's cop intuition. There's manpower and training that was present and on the ground, and also civilian cooperation and vigilance that led to this arrest. We sort of get bombarded by all these different technologies. I mean, I can't get from point A to point B without looking at my GPS. I no longer look at a map. I don't use my intuition. Back then, the only thing they had was a car radio. You couldn't even take that radio outside with you. So the reporters, the cops, there was a lot more intuitive work that went into this manhunt for Oswald and trusting your gut. And that's what they talk about, as reporter and police instinct. And certainly the people that I talked to had it.
Grindling's grandfather, Detective Lavelle, says their investigation didn't stop with the in-custody death of Lee Oswald. And the leads they chased down for nothing, especially when someone would make something up, that resulted in endless frustration.
As far as I'm concerned, people like that, ought to have a front seat in hell. But I don't know how many thousands of man hours that we spent between us, intelligence division, and other people running down, trying to run down that story and prove that it happened. But that's what we had to contend with.
Now imagine a family member of those shot. Officer J.D. Tippett left behind a widow and three children. We all remember that famous image of John F. Kennedy Jr. saluting his father at the funeral. For one family, November 22nd served as a long stretch of time when they did not know if their loved one would live or die. Mark Connolly was 11 years old when his father was with President Kennedy in the motorcade. He was looking forward to meeting the president later that day, until his brother rushed into the school earlier than he was expecting.
He came in quite a hurry and scooped me up and took me out. And I thought we were simply late, that they'd gotten in early and we were going to meet them. My sister had heard different, and she was very distraught. She had heard they'd both been shot in the head. And so I actually learned in the car what had gone on with my brother and my sister, brother being 17. And then when we arrived back at the governor's mansion, I think the most frightening, striking memory is walking into a room downstairs, and every adult I saw was crying. And as an 11-year-old, you didn't see large groups of adults crying at one time. Maybe someone at a funeral or a couple of people, but not a mass like this. That was horrifically impactful.
They had to wait for up to 6 hours while their father, Texas Governor John Connally, was being operated on at Parkland Hospital.
It was an extensive surgery, and we didn't know whether he was going to make it or not. And so that was a pretty vivid memory as well. My brother, being the oldest, was allowed to come that day, and we came several days later. I remember the first time I saw Dad was Thanksgiving Day. We had a modified Thanksgiving lunch together in Parkland Hospital.
Parkland Hospital was, to put it lightly, absolutely chaotic, as doctors desperately tried to do anything for the president. One of the doctors later said that had the patient not been the president of the United States, they most likely would have taken one look and said, "This man is dead," and pronounced the patient deceased right there. But this was the president. Aubrey Reich was an ambulance driver who witnessed the chaos at Parkland and, for the most part, had a front-row view while waiting for any direction on how he could help. When I talked to him years ago, I was still in high school. He agreed to talk to me at a hotel outside in a courtyard by the pool. And this is before I learned a technique called proper microphone placement. So again, I find myself apologizing for the quality of the audio here. He described the commotion given the number of different officials who were crammed into the emergency room area of the hospital.
You got federal people, you got state people, because you know, the governor got shot. You got city people because it happened in the city. You got county people because the hospital's in the county. You know, there's just mass confusion all the way around. People accusing each other. You know, done this or done that, you know, it's just one of those type of deals that they're trying to blame each other for it, you know.
While Reich was waiting and observing the unbelievable scene, he decided to walk over to the cigarette machine. He then walked back toward the emergency area outside Trauma Room 1. Mrs. Kennedy was just outside. Reich tells this amazing story of his encounter with the former First Lady and the Secret Service.
I opened the cigarettes up, got me one out and lit it up. Miss Kennedy asked me if she could have a cigarette. I said, sure. Anyway, a Secret Service man grabbed my wrist, twisted it, takes the cigarettes out, jerked it open like this, you know, cigarettes go flying everywhere. And he gave Miss Kennedy a cigarette, and then he asked me for a light.
Reich has no memory of Jackie Kennedy putting out the cigarette, but he did notice she eventually was concerned about the amount of blood all over her clothing.
Well, later on, she was sitting there and she kept rubbing her, like she was trying to rub the blood off of her. And so I jumped down, got her towel out of the scrub room there, wet it, and handed it to her. And she started rubbing it off, and believe it or not, you know, a lot of that blood come out.
The Secret Service then confirmed with Reich that he worked at a mortuary. He was told they needed a casket. Reich, along with his ambulance partner, picked up JFK's body and placed it in the casket. Reich's hands were on the back of the president's head and the small of his back.
Now, when I first picked his head up, he had, I could feel, you know, the jagged edges of the brain, I mean, of the skull. I could feel that, and then I could feel the brain moving around in the hand. And we needed to get a plastic sheet and line the casket with it so the blood would.
The Secret Service tried to remove the body as quickly as possible because they wanted to get President Lyndon Johnson out of Dallas and get everyone back to Washington. However, the local Dallas medical examiner tried to get in the way by forcing the body to stay in Dallas for an autopsy. At the time, the murder of the President of the United States was, to the Dallas officials, just another homicide. The Secret Service threatened the local guys to get out of the way, and they pushed the casket back to the ambulance and drove off to Dallas Love Field in Air Force One, where President Johnson was already on board. Then the swearing in, and back to Washington they flew. This extraordinary phone call was released by the JFK Library of the new president, Lyndon Johnson, and new First Lady, Lady Bird Johnson, calling President Kennedy's mother, Rose Kennedy, aboard Air Force One.
Mr. Kennedy?
Well,
I wish to God there were something that I could do, and I wanted to tell you that we were grieving with you.
Yes, well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. I know you love Jack and he loves you.
Two days later, in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters, the third death of the weekend would play out, this time live on television. Now, NBC was the only network that actually broadcasted it live as it happened. CBS and ABC, well, they jumped into the footage immediately after it was obvious something was going wrong. But there were other newsmen in the basement whose reporting was not meant to be live at all, but recorded and played back later. Gary DeLon was a reporter for KLIF Radio in Dallas. He did news and sports, but his main beat was the police reporter.
There wasn't a great deal of security. Let's face it, it's not like today's cordoning of a whole area. Now, I think there were two police officers on one side, the up ramp, two on the other side, the down ramp. And so I just walked down the ramp that was the exit ramp, and there were two clusters of newsmen, one to the left where he was going to come and the other on the right. That's the group that Ruby was in. And what he had done, he had, in a clandestine manner, zipped down that in ramp when one of the cops was distracted. So he was over in that group with Bob Huffaker and the others. I was in the group to the left, standing next to Bob Jackson, who shot that unbelievable photo, and started describing what happened. And KLIF was owned, as you well know, by Gordon McClendon, and he did not spend a lot of money on tape recorders and things like that. So the quality I had that morning was not the greatest. I said, here comes Captain Wilfritz leading the way. And I was watching him, basically, and here comes the accused assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald. And I saw this blur out of the corner of my eye. And as I was still concentrating on Oswald, I saw Jim Lovell try to jerk him a little bit, and then the gun, and then the shot.
Here he comes, Lee Oswald, the accused assassin, Captain Wilfritz leading the way. Being escorted by police officers and sheriff. The shot rang out, the shot has rung out, and Lee Oswald falls. Lee Oswald has fallen. A shot has rung out here. A struggle is being in place. Shot has rung out. And ladies and gentlemen, Lee Oswald has just been shot.
What is amazing is I don't remember what I said after I ran back to the station. I don't remember exactly. You know, I was out of breath, no doubt. Don't forget that he had buildings all the way around and you couldn't cut through. I had to run up the street and then back down the street to the studios. If I hadn't gone on a volunteer basis, KLIF would have never had it on the air.
For DeLon, for Bob Jackson, for Bob Welch, whose WBAP broadcast of the breaking news you heard in the opening episode, for everyone, this weekend changed them. For the better? Maybe. Maybe not. Secret Service officers in shock, some developing PTSD. Journalists breaking down on the air. And this weekend provided a real-life understanding of how life can be. Walter Cronkite offering his thoughts on what life might be like as he signed off the air following President Kennedy's funeral. And nearly 50 years after that, Jim Lehrer looked back on how life was and how the assassination changed him professionally.
The Kennedy assassination, the impact it had on me professionally as a journalist was profound as an individual now, as an individual journalist, and in many ways that have stayed with me for 50 years. And first and foremost, I learned, and I was only 4 years into journalism at that. I had been a reporter for 4 years at that time. I learned at that early stage in my journalism career just how fragile everything is, that it was possible for one man to go to a window, fire three rounds, 15 seconds, and change the course of history. And that was the first of those kinds of events that we Americans and we journalists, in the modern world at least, had confronted. It was after that came the other events, like the assassination of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King, but also Vietnam in a major way, and Watergate, and then of course. But what it did for me was it made me always alert to the fact that at any given moment, you could be sitting at a fancy hotel in North Dallas, and or North Hollywood, or North New York City, or wherever, and boom, all hell could break loose.
It is said that the human mind has a greater capacity for remembering the pleasant than the unpleasant. But the day was a day that will live in memory and in grief. Only history can write the importance of this day. Were these dark days the harbingers of even blacker ones to come? Or like the black before the dawn, shall they lead to some still as yet undiscernible sunrise of understanding among men, that violent words, no matter what their origin or motivation, can lead only to violent deeds? This is the larger question that will be answered in part in the manner that a shaken civilization seeks the answers to the immediate questions. Who, and most importantly, what was Lee Harvey Oswald? A world's doubts must be put to rest. Tonight, there will be few Americans who will go to bed without carrying with them a sense that somehow they have failed. If in the search of our conscience we find a new dedication to the American concepts that brook no political, sectional, religious, or racial divisions, then maybe it may yet be possible to say that John Fitzgerald Kennedy did not die in vain. That's the way it is. Monday, November 25th, 1963. This is Walter Cronkite. Good night.
The stories of these people will live in the history books, in the documentaries, and in various programs that take a look at American history. But there is one area where the assassination story lives, where artistic license is frequent, and entertainment is key. Hollywood. The box office. Where the movie trailer to a 3.5-hour 1991 epic claims is the story that won't go away. I'm Eric Bushman. This is the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas.